From the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Writer's Talk. I'm Doug Dangler. Michael Ferrari earned a degree in cinema at The Ohio State University and worked as a film and video editor in Los Angeles for 16 years. He also has a master's degree in English literature and creative writing from California State University in LA, and eventually returned to Ohio with his family to teach screenwriting at Oberlin College and Cleveland State University. His first book, Born to Fly, is a work of historical fiction for middle grade children. Welcome to Writer's Talk, Michael Ferrari.
Thank you.
So tell me, what did Ohio have to offer that LA didn't, so that brought you back?
Both my wife and my family lives in Ohio. My wife comes from nine children, so all her siblings were here, and my family is here, so eventually we wanted to move back, be near the grandparents and cousins and such.
I thought it was the weather.
Well, I don't mind the weather, tell you the truth. I miss the seasons in California, so I didn't mind coming back, actually.
Okay. So Born to Fly is your first novel, and it was the manuscript from your master's thesis, right?
Yes.
And then it was chosen by Delacorte Press for the Delacorte Yearling Prize. Tell me about that.
It's a prize for first middle grade novel, and the award is you get an advance and they publish your book. So it's a great prize. I submitted to the contest and was lucky enough to win.
Okay. It's not an annual prize, right? But just when they find it something they really like.
Right. They have the contest yearly, but they only select a winner when they think somebody
really like
should
it.
Win. So I think twice in the last 10 years.
All right. What are their criteria for that? Do they tell you about that, or is it?
There's around the page, less than 200 pages, and then it should be written for middle grade, and they don't want subject matter that would really be a young adult novel generally. They want it towards that audience, so it shouldn't be too written down to a younger audience or to an older audience. That's basically it.
And I'm taking that you already had the novel and everything, so you didn't have to conform to those criteria. It just happened
happened to fit, yeah.
Fit within that. Then they published the book, and you went on to international fame, fortune.
I think I actually won the award in November 2007, maybe they told me. And then it was another year and a half before the book last summer. They published it in July.
Okay. What happens in that year and a half?
You go through a couple revisions. They give you editor's notes, and then there are also proofreader notes where they have fact checkers and things where they'll say, kids didn't really say that phrase in 1940. That didn't come into play until 1950. And you're like, I had no idea. It just seemed like an old phrase that kids would say. Cool. Yep.
Yeah.
Funny things like that.
I'm curious as a writer, what other kind of feedback you got from the publishers? Either there are proofreading notes where they do the fact checking, but did they talk to you about the story itself as a...
Surprisingly, I didn't make much changes to the story. They were like, boy, we think it's almost... It's almost ready to go as it was. There was one scene where they said, could you beef this up a little bit, this courtroom scene that was in there? They wanted some more stuff there. And there might have been one other note where they said, could you explain a little bit more about the... at the end of the book, they wanted me to write this afterward, kind of giving historical context of, the internment camps and kind of how that came about.
Mm-hmm. I was interested in that when I read the epilogue, because I thought it's one of those moments where you have to tread sort of lightly. And I sensed that, or I thought that there would be probably a difficult thing to write just from the political sense, because you're talking about the Japanese internment camp, and one of the main characters in the story is Kenji, and he's a Japanese student that starts the school, going to school with the main character Bird, and how much did you do a research on that in order to work through the ramifications of that?
I read a number of books on it, and I talked to some people. My wife knew somebody who was in, he was actually a boy in the internment camps, and I talked with him, and it wasn't real deep, because it's kind of backstory. My story doesn't actually take place with the internment camps. It's just kind of a backstory for the one character. But I just needed to have kind of an understanding of, boy, was this possible since he's sent east to avoid going in there? And I was like, boy, is that really possible? Were they able to do that? And they only worried about people on the West Coast, and that really was kind of the case. Just in the Western states, they sent them, whereas people on the East Coast, they didn't send them to the internment camp. So.
Okay. All right. Well, tell me a little bit more about the book, since we've talked about it in general terms. Can you give us your elevator speech?
Oh, a quick little pitch of the story.
Right.
Yeah, it's a story about two kind of outcast kids. The main character's named Bird McGill. She's a 11-year-old girl who wants to be a fighter pilot, and she becomes friends with a Japanese-American boy who's like kind of an internment camp refugee sent east to avoid the internment camps. And the two of them kind of stumble on a spy in their hometown, and they kind of have to stop him before he ultimately is going to try to kill the president.
Okay. What kind of background were you influenced by when you were writing this book? What other authors did you have in mind when you did it? There were a couple times reading it, I thought about some other literary characters. I thought about people in To Kill a Mockingbird and things like that. So what was in your mind?
I thought a little bit definitely about that, because I've got like a courtroom sequence in this. Mm-hmm. And so I was thinking of, from a child's point of view, how that story is told, you know. I thought about... my background was in film mostly, so a lot of it was like film things, and so it would be a coming of age story, or maybe a World War II film. Like it was a spy movie that I really liked. I guess it doesn't pertain to my thing, but that I was thinking of it, called Eye of the Needle, which is kind of a spy film with Donald Sutherland. And I'm trying to think if there was any other. I mean, the writers I liked were not necessarily this kind of historical fiction. I mean, I always liked like Beverly Cleary and Judy Blume and those kinds of basically middle grade writers. They would be called, I guess, today. And so I just tried to write, you know, from a child's point of view and that voice, if I could, as best I could.
And middle grade is 8 to 11. Is it roughly in that?
Yeah.
That, so
8 to 11, 9 to 12, 8 to 12. That's
so. What is it? The tweens, I guess, is the other term for it. Yeah.
Right before the teen years. Yeah.
Okay. Well, how about you read a little bit of it and give us a sense of the story, and we'll listen to that.
Okay. I'm just going to give you a little bit of kind of set up the scene, because it's kind of in the middle of the story. So we know who those two main characters are, Bird and Kenji, and they haven't become friends yet. He's come to the town. She used to be kind of like the one who was picked on in the town. And when he first arrived, she's kind of glad that, oh, here's the new kid. He's taken my place as, you know, the one who's getting picked on. But eventually she's going to realize they have more in common. So this scene, it's like a Saturday afternoon, and they've been to the movies. Kenji went to the movies, and Bird couldn't go because Kenji stole her report topic. She had to spend the day looking for these marsh weeds. And now he's about to get beat up by these two bullies, Farley and Raymond. And so she's deciding she's going to help him out. "Hey, over here," I yelled. Kenji spotted me but seemed suspicious. "Stay out of this, Bird Brain," Farley hollered when he saw me. He and Raymond speeded up as I started to cast off. "Hurry," I told Kenji. "Come on." It was clear he had no choice but to trust me. He splashed through the water and flopped into the rowboat. Farley and Raymond, neither one a good swimmer, sloshed into the water after us. I quickly shoved the other oar into Kenji's hand. "Row, stupid." He did, but not very well. We rowed furiously, but our strokes were fighting each other, causing the boat to zigzag. Suddenly, Farley popped his head out of the water and grabbed hold of my oar. "Got you, Jap lover." His grimy hands were a lot stronger than mine, and it took all my weight to keep him from tipping the boat over. But Kenji thought fast and swatted his oar, splashing water right up Farley's nose. It worked. Farley started coughing out seawater and let go of my paddle. After a few more sloppy strokes, Kenji and I found a 1-2 rhythm, and we started to pull away. Farley and Raymond chased us as far as the sandbar cut off, but once they went underwater and realized they couldn't touch bottom, they decided to retreat. Looking like two drenched rats, the bullies barked and bellyached from the shore. "Chicken," taunted Raymond. "Traitor," screamed Farley. "You'll pay for this, Bird." As we pulled away, Farley and Raymond shrank in the distance. Feeling safe, I stopped rowing and let us drift into the bay. "One thing about Farley, he swims about as good as an anchor," I joked. Kenji was silent, catching his breath. "Don't say thanks or anything," I snapped. "Thanks," he said. "It's the least I could do after you stole my report topic," I told him. "I didn't steal it," he said. "Anyway, if you want it so bad, take it." "What, you mean it?" "It's just a stupid airplane," he said. "Airplanes aren't stupid," I told him, "especially warhawks." Just what kind of weirdo was this kid? "Don't you know they had a 10-to-1 kill ratio in China against the Japs?" And then I shut myself up. What was I saying? He was a Jap. I meant, you know, the Japanese. "I know what you meant," he said. Great. Now it was going to be a long, uncomfortable silence, and I'd probably say something stupid like, "My little brother still pees in this water when he goes swimming." "Oh my God," I thought. "Did I really just say that?" Kenji looked at me like I was a polka-dotted sea slug. I couldn't help it. When things got quiet and uncomfortable, I'd sometimes say stupid stuff. Like once, we were all sitting around the Christmas dinner table waiting for Grandma to say grace, and she passed gas. I mean a really big one. But everyone pretended like she didn't and just held their breath while she kept on praying. Uncle Rupert was practically turning blue. Finally, I couldn't take the silence and blurted out, I didn't know you knew how to fart, Grandma. I had to eat dinner in Grandma's cellar for that one. But Dad told me later I probably saved Uncle Rupert from having an asthma attack. I just meant, you know, I wouldn't gulp down any of this water if you ever go swimming in the bay here, I explained. Sure, Kenji said. He reached into his jacket and carefully pulled out a soggy yellow Milk Duds box. It was empty. He pulled another one out of his shirt pocket. Nothing. Then he found a third one in his back pants pocket. He dug his fingers in deep and pulled out the sorriest-looking, most waterlogged chocolate-covered caramel I'd ever seen. He was about to pop it in his mouth when he felt me staring and stopped. Milk Dud? He said, offering it to me first. No thanks. Kenji shrugged okay and started chomping away. His foot happened to bump the fishing rod in the boat, so he leaned over and picked it up, kind of gently. Is this your rod? Nope, it's Father Krause's. Oh. He examined the assortment of fancy lures and treble hooks dangling on the lead. I pointed to the silver lure with the tiny mirrors on both sides. That's his favorite lure. It's a pretty fancy setup, Kenji said. You fish? I asked. My father used to. He's gone now. You mean dead? I said, surprised. I guess I hadn't really thought about how this kid ended up living with his uncle here in Geneseo. More or less, he said. More or less? That didn't make sense. How could someone be more dead or less dead? You either are or you aren't, right? I said. What do you mean? I mean it's none of your business. So I shut up. I'd found that was the best thing to do when someone said, it's none of your business. I was trying to figure Kenji out, but it was almost like he was joking about his dad being dead. Or maybe he didn't care. Kenji grabbed the rod and tossed the line into the water. So what do you catch around here? Lately, nothing. Because of the Jenny, I said matter-of-factly. What's the Jenny? Do you scare easy? I asked. What do you think? He scoffed. I saw Frankenstein 3 times in a row and I only shut my eyes once. Okay, you asked for it. I had him just where I wanted him. So I began to relate the legend of the Jenny. And I'll stop there.
Thanks. In that excerpt, you can get a real sense of the characters and their relationships. When you write something like that, are you thinking back to the kinds of relationships that you had as a kid? Who did you identify with in that story as the writer?
Yeah, I probably did. Because often other people in my writing group, and why did you write a girl? Or how could you write a girl? And I'm like, you know, I didn't really think about it that much. I wasn't trying to overly analyze, I just kind of thought, how does a kid feel, a girl, whatever, a character who wants to fly an airplane? How does she talk? What does she think about? Tried to remember, you know, what were the things that were important when you're in that age? What's funny when you're that age? You know, that kind of thing. At the time when I was first starting to get the idea for the story, I was teaching at the time too, 6th grade. So I was around kids that age. And, you know, if you've been away for it for a while, you kind of forget maybe sometimes how they talk a little bit. But
you might wish to forget occasionally how they talk at the time.
But so you get into their mindset and I went from there.
Okay. So you said that you're in a writing group. And what were their reactions to the book other than the one you were describing? The first reaction is, why, as a male, are you writing a female character? But what other kind of reactions and advice have you gotten out of it? What sort of impact has that had on your writing?
Oh, it's been great. Writing is a very solitary kind of thing, so you really need some kind of feedback, and it's good to get out of the house, you know, away from your computer or whatever, and talk with people and get a reaction to your writing before takes years, you know, sometimes to get published, usually, and so it's nice to have somebody respond to it. The writing group that I have now was, I'd already finished the book, so they read it afterwards, but they've all been very supportive and, you know, just love the character and things. But while I was writing it, and I was in a writing group also when I wrote the book in California. So everybody's, you know, as long as you have people you trust and supportive of you, it's great.
Okay. What are the mechanics of that? You meet once a week? Does it have to be physical? Do you do online stuff?
No, we do online. You know, I didn't... When I was first working on this, it was what we'd probably meet once a month, maybe. But now we have a monthly meeting. We meet at a bookstore, and most of it is actually we talk about like kind of the craft of writing, not in general. Once every 6 months, I think we do a critique group, but in general, our critique is online. Yeah, we post pages on online and critique it there.
Okay. What kind of critiques have you received on it, just sort of in general? What are the kind of reactions do you get back?
Or you know, it's been very, you know, very positive for the most part. I don't know if I've even read like a really negative review of it at all. Everyone's, other than some people may, oh, it seems unbelievable, you know, kind of the adventure. But I mean, that's kind of the point. I wanted it to be kind of an action hero who was an 11-year-old girl that I hadn't seen. That was kind of the impetus for me to write the book. And so everything's been very positive. It's funny, I get a lot of like grandparents who've read it, like with their, and they're like, oh, I just love this. You know, they're the ones who'll tell me they love it, you know, the kids too. But it's always fun to hear parents saying, oh, boy, you didn't grow up in this time. How do you know any of the stuff that was going on? How do you know they had these, you know, what things looked like or what was hanging in the windows? And you just do a little research and you can fill that out.
Now, I've read that you were inspired to write this book in sort of two ways. You said you were teaching junior high, I think, and you had a book report assigned to your students, and couldn't find a hero who was female in an action story. So have you found one since then?
Boy, you know, I really haven't. Not similar to like this. Not really like an action adventure. I mean, a lot of times they're teamed. They have them like teamed up, and like the brother and sister in 39 Clues are like that, and kind of in a little bit in like Percy Jackson and things. The sidekicks are, but there wasn't one where it was really the girl's story, you know. Mm-hmm. But it reminded me that, because I just read an interview, I think a week or two ago, it was the same kind of idea. Beverly Cleary, it was like her birthday, 94th birthday, and they asked her, you know, what do you recall? And she says, well, you know, that's how I got into writing. She goes, I was a librarian, and nobody was writing contemporary stories about boys at the time. And she said, this little boy came up to me, he says, where are the books about kids like us? And she says, that's why she wrote Henry Huggins, you know, and that's the same kind of thing. I had that girl come up to me, she was looking for that kind of thing, and I tried to suggest a book, I couldn't think of one. And then a few years before that, I had been at this World War II air show, and I'd overheard like a boy and a girl, you know, kind of like arguing and teasing. She wanted to be a fighter pilot, and he said, girls couldn't be fighter pilots. So I was like, that was the story. That was the character. A girl wanted to be a fighter pilot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There's also a lot, you said that you did a lot of research for World War II. And part of the thing that you were doing at that air show was hooking a camera up to a airplane.
Yes.
To go fly. Do you fly in airplanes? Because there's a scene in here where there's a lot to do with her having to fly the airplane. Is that part of research, or you just took
it? I happened to, because of the job I was at. That was a series we did on World War II planes. And my one boss was a pilot, and so we did a lot of flying. And I wasn't a pilot, and he kept trying to get me interested, and I was kind of like, ah, it was okay. But I did get to go in a number of planes. I didn't get to go in the Warhawk because it was really only a one-seater plane, but I went in like a B-25 Mitchell bomber and a B-17 I got to fly in, and then a number of private, you know, just single-engine planes and things. I flew quite a bit, so I kind of talked with him and pilot, and I was in planes, so I kind of understood a little bit of the chatter that goes back and mm-hmm. forth and some things like that.
Now, in that list, I didn't hear P-40, right? You didn't get up in the...
I didn't get up in the... I mean, I walked around it on the ground, but I didn't get to fly it, okay. No. It's the cockpit's pretty small, actually. I mean, I'm trying to think if they actually did have a trainer for it where you could do... I mean, I kind of cheated. She sits in the lap of this other pilot and flies it, but it's pretty tight in there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. It also seems to me that, you know, that's a big jump. I don't know that I'd be willing to get for a book into a airplane that's going on, what, 60, 70, how many years old now?
Definitely. It's a 1930s plane, so it's 70 years old, yes.
Okay. Well, if you're not willing to go that extra mile for the research, what
you gotta fake it, you know? Yeah. Get a flight simulator.
There's also, as we had mentioned, the sort of a wartime theme of racism in the book with the Japanese internment camps. And they don't play a large part in it, but they do, as you said, create the backstop of it. And I'm curious what kind of reactions you've gotten to that. Is it people are surprised the kids didn't know about it when they read it, or they kind of get that glossed over in history? What's the...
I think the kids aren't real, you know, they don't really understand it at first, and because things have changed quite a bit, maybe not, you know, completely, there's obviously still racism and intolerance, but they didn't fully understand. So that's when I go to the school, I explain kind of, you know, the country was attacked by the Japanese, and so there was this great fear, and ultimately unreasonable. There were no instances of, you know, Japanese sabotage or anything, mm-hmm. but... I think, you know, the kids get it. They totally get that part of the story. I think the teachers really like it because it's an easier entry point for them to get into the story, because that's not what the story is about, per se. It's not like, oh, it's a story about intolerance. It's this adventure, but we have this thing happen where he's, you know, incriminate him and his uncle are blamed for the sabotage simply because, oh, well, it's got to be the Japanese guy who did it because he looks different than us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, you are here doing, you've written this book, but you're also in Ohio teaching screenwriting.
Yes.
So if you option the book, are you going to do the screenplay for
it? Yes, I would hope so. I would hope so. At least one draft until they kick me off and hire another writer to rewrite me.
What kind of differences do you feel about writing a novel and versus writing a screenplay? What would you advise yourself to do if you were going to turn this into a screenplay?
Well, you just have to find a way to get a character's thoughts out in another way, through their actions or through a symbolic thing that you can't give as much backstory about. Like, you can't say what happened when Bird's thinking about what happened to her in first grade, you know, with this other history of something that happened when somebody did something before. Obviously, you can't get that across, so maybe you get it in a piece of dialogue, or you just show something, an artifact someone has that they're remembering their sister who went away or something, and that's her ribbon in her hair. You just have to find some kind of alternative way to get that across.
So when you switched from doing screenwriting to this novel, was it a big switch for you? Because now you get to do all the backstory. Or did you feel like you're not going to put as much emphasis on dialogue?
It was hard at first. It really was, because screenwriting is a very compressed kind of writing. It's very spare. And the whole point is you're not trying to give all those extra details. You need to get fast into all. So when I first started, it was very kind of dry that way. It was a little too bare bones. You know, you really wanted to, no, you can take your time and you can just let her think and react. And she's walking through the woods. It's not like a dead moment in a screenplay where someone's just walking and they're looking at the trees and hearing sounds. No, you can actually like really get the senses to the audience. So it took a little bit to really get into that mindset. I think when I go back and forth, it's still kind of thing. It takes a little bit where I gotta, oh yeah, I'm doing a screenplay. This is not like a book.
So you're going back and forth and you're thinking, this is not a screenplay, this is a book, or this is a novel. What's the process? You said you go to a bookstore, obviously, for the writer's discussion group. But when you're actually writing, where are you? Do you have set times? What's your process?
Boy, you know, I've got like a 4-year-old and a 7-year-old and 11-year-old, and my wife is like works full time, and then I teach part time, and so it's tough to find the to get the structure of the time. I do writing at like the library. I go to the library. Like, I try to go 2 hours every day, but it doesn't always work out that way when there's other stuff to do. I did a lot of this was written like in the basement of the university library. Even after I had finished my degree, I'd still go back there and write in that basement. This research area where there was nobody would be down there for like 4 hours. It'd be like the person at the desk and me, and so it was quiet. I could get some writing done there. But that's really where I haven't found a place at home that I can. The house just is not quiet enough. I don't have a study or anything there yet. So
that whole room of one's own.
Yes,
it is. So you have to leave. And
I have to leave.
Well, else.
Part of that I think is good, because it also gives you a sense like you're kind of like going to work, and I'm going to write. You know, you're not going to get phone calls. You're not going to deal with stuff that's happening at home. That kind of thing.
Okay. What's your plans for the next book?
I'm about halfway done. Through a second book now. It's kids keep asking, oh, is it a sequel? I'm like, a sequel? What am I going to do with a sequel? And then they came up with these great ideas for a sequel. I was like, oh,
well,
you know.
So stealing ideas from children.
Hey,
yeah,
you know, I have no problem with that. They gave them to me. That's the way it works. Ideas can't be copyrighted. But this one is since this one was like kind of, even though we had two characters, it was really the girl's story. The next one's a boy. He's like a 14-year-old, and his father is like a daredevil in a circus, and he is killed in a fire saving this little girl who worked at the circus and doing this heroic thing. And so then the boy makes up his mind he's never going to do anything heroic ever. And so now it's years later, he's 14, and he goes with his mother around the world, around the country, and kind of like a traveling flea market. They sell things. And through some magic, that they end up at this movie theater where they're going to set up their flea market, and this movie character comes to life. Off the screen, old 1950s cowboy, good guy, white hat hero, and he's going to like teach the boy kind of how to be a hero and grow up and be a man. And in the process, there's like a little bit of a mystery that the actor who played that that movie character died, but he was actually murdered. So they're going to kind of solve his murder in the process. It's called Malcolm Devlin and the Shadow of a Hero.
Okay. So Purple Rose of Cairo for...
Kind of Purple Rose of Cairo, yes. Children. I was definitely thinking of that.
Okay. Well, Jeff Daniels will certainly be up for... It's all for the same age group then. You're looking
it is,
for the
it's,
same...
It's a little bit older. It's like, I don't know how the market... He's 14 right now, so... It's a little bit older than middle grade, but it's not quite young adult, I guess.
Okay. And that's sort of the age group that your children are in. You've got an 11-year-old. You say, do you read the books to them, and do you get their feedback?
I do. I read it to them, and then I wanted them to read it, and it took them like 2 years or a year and a half for my daughter to finally pick it up and read it on her own. Hey, I like this. And I was like, well, I tried to get you to read it, you know, when it was in manuscript form.
Mm-hmm. But there's nothing in your house like you'll read 4 pages before you go to bed, or you get no supper tomorrow, things like that.
Yeah, I do not twist their arm and make them read my pages and give me feedback.
Okay. Do you read now in this genre more than you did before? And do you look for clues in the genre, say in Harry Potter or something like that? Which I think the first one is sort of in the same area, but then,
Right, and then it moves on. I find myself reading more in this genre probably just because my kids are in that age and they're bringing those books home, so I'm reading books with them, you know?
Okay, so not only do you steal the children's ideas, you take their books when they come home.
Exactly, I take their books and try to learn what I can from whatever they're reading.
All right. Who's on your nightstand right now?
You know, I'm reading this book called Wolves of the Beyond, which I think Catherine Lasky, it's very good. It's a little bit of a Moses kind of a intro. This wolf is kind of orphaned because he's got a deformed paw and he's raised by like a grizzly bear who lost her cubs.
Okay. So it's a, is it, I mean, it's a story that has the animals as
the main
characters.
From the animals' point of view.
Okay. I was curious about that because you went from what is, you know, it's a little bit adventurous, but relatively it could happen, you know, within a certain realm, to your next book has, as you said, magic.
Right. It's fantastic. The next one, isn't
it? It seems like that would change you as a writer. It seems like you're having to go from a fact checker to in the first book to the second book, the fact checker can't say, well, that's not the kind of magic we like.
That's true. But you still have to set up your rules and kind of stick by them. You know, you can't just say, well, they can do that, and then something else happens later in the story. Well, you said that, you know, this is the, you know, I set up these rules, there's like this magic candle and it's burning, and when the candle's gone, the guy's going to be gone, you know? And so you can't kind of stretch it when it burns out, how am I going to bring him back? Do I? Well, you can't really break your magic rules. You got to kind of set it up and stick by the world you create.
Mm-hmm. All right. What's your final advice for writers to get their first book published? It's a very different landscape.
You know what? I talked with my writers group. I had a meeting with them where they wanted me to kind of like talk about the publishing process. And really, the most important thing that happened to me was, I mean, it was a while before it actually got published, but it was... it was an attitude change. I tell them, because we really had an epiphany, and it was just like this one day where I realized, you know what, I'm not gonna be like shy or ashamed or like, you know, oh, I'm a writer. When people ask you, do you write? Yeah, well, not really. You know, I'm a, because they ask, you know, well, what have you written? And well, nothing you've heard of, because nothing's been published. And once your attitude changes from that, where you just write with confidence, regardless of whether you're published or not, you just write, I know this, what I'm writing about, but I'm the only person who can write this story because it's my story. I came up with it. And you get this confidence, and then your writing just changes. Your whole attitude about it changes. And it really just changed everything for me.
Well, that's great advice. So write with confidence.
Write with confidence.
Well, Michael Ferrari, thank you very much for being here on Writer's Talk.
It was great being here.
And from the Center for the Study and Teaching of Writing at The Ohio State University, this is Doug Dankler saying, keep writing.